Hey, everybody. This is the TCP. I am John Stamp, and I don't know if it's the same with you guys, but it is full tilt into the holidays here. Getting decorating done-ish, hiding Amazon deliveries from the boys, trying to keep our new pair of cats. I don't know if I've introduced Peter and Parker, our new cats, yet, but they are giant fans of climbing through a Christmas tree, and they've almost taken like a 10-foot Christmas tree down like three times just this week. I've had to figure out how to anchor stuff to walls now, which is odd. Regardless, December has come on way too fast. I was not ready for it. That's not to say I'm not enjoying it, but in case I forget, because I'm known to do that, I want to just start with a happy holidays to everybody, and I hope it's going well. Thanksgiving was fast, and I really hope that your Christmas or whatever you happen to celebrate this December is a great experience for you. And before I get started tonight, a quick update on Overmatch. I'm on my second round of edits, and so far Shelly, my editor, has not quit. So I take that to mean that Overmatch is moving in the right direction. And so far, she's able to take my garble and translate it into something that sounds intelligent that hopefully you are really going to enjoy reading. Covers in the works. Really looking forward to seeing what Jeffrey Hayes has for me in the very near future. So thinking hopefully maybe March, April release for Overmatch, the second Ty Benhoff novel. I can't wait. And as soon as I know more, you will know more. So that's it on the writing front for today. So let's get to it, huh? Tonight, I get to sit down with radio host and true crime author Alan R. Warren. Alan Warren is a best-selling author, producer, and lead host of the popular NBC radio shows House of Mystery and Inside Writing, both heard on 106 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside, 1050 AM Palm Springs, 540 AM KYAH Salt Lake City, and 1150 AM KKNW in Seattle, Tacoma, and Phoenix. Al started writing articles for True Case Files magazine and is still a contributor to Serial Killer magazine. He's also completed 24 nonfiction books covering true crime, cults, human trafficking, history, and memoirs for three different publishers. His best-selling true crime books in Canada are Beyond Suspicion, The True Story of Colonel Russell Williams, which was featured on CNN's Lies, Crimes, and Videos, and Murder Time 6, The True Story of the Wells Gray Park Murders in America. His bestsellers include The Killing Game, Serial Killer Rodney Alcalia, which has been featured on several television shows, such as Very Scary People with Donnie Wahlberg, Oxygen's Mark of the Killer, Reels, Killer Trophies, and soon to be featured in a four-part documentary on the Sundance channel called Death's Date. He's also written Doomsday Cults, The Devil's Hostages, which was featured on Vice's Dark Side of the 90s. His latest series of books is called Killer Queens, a six-part series covering murders that affect the gay community, including stories revolving around Leopold and Loeb, The Butcher of Hanover, Fritz Harman, The Grinder Serial Killer, Stephen Port, and book four, Bruce MacArthur, The Toronto Gay Killer. So I can't wait to talk to him. His writing is so varied and unique, and his shows are great. So Al, thank you very much for joining me tonight.
Well, thanks for having me. Boy, that guy sounds like he's busy.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I was like, first question just has to be, when and how do you sleep? I just don't see it.
it doesn't happen. I think that you just get into it and you just do a lot. I don't think it's like anything too wild. I just do what I do. And I need more sleep. That's true.
Don't we all? I just can't, I can't find enough in today's day and age. And I have nowhere near as busy as you are. Between the radio show and 24 different books, as I was going through them, first off, I kind of wonder, how did this come about? What was first, radio or television, or or writing?
Oh, radio for sure. Books, actually, I've got 30 published now.
Wow.
I know it's, I think that's just what's done on the PR stuff, but no, I've got 30 books out there now and four different publishers now. No, radio was first. I'm a radio kid, always have been, since I was young. I mean, 5 and 6, I was listening to, all I did was listen to radio. I didn't turn on the TV and unless it was Batman, you know, we're talking the 1960s.
the Alan West Batman.
Yeah, we're talking old. So, yeah, I'd watch, other than really weird shows like that or Dragnet or something, I never watched much TV. I was really a big fan of radio. I had like 15 radios, the old crystal radio. That's all I did was radio.
And those were the ones that you could like take apart and fix and remove transistors and all the old set, like when you could actually replace stuff and fix things instead of just throwing them out and getting a new one. Like, I've talked to other people and that's where those collections come from. Cause they're just not as, you used to be able to tinker with stuff like that. Right.
Yeah. And I was fascinated with the whole idea of it. Right. That's all I was, is a radio guy. And that's how I got into making, producing and working other people's shows. More than being on the air initially, because, you know, I was, I didn't realize it, but as a kid, I'm autistic and, on being on the spectrum, I didn't understand my issues, because I thought I was normal. And back in the 60s and 70s, they didn't really do anything for you other than, give you a slap because they thought you were a bad kid, right? You weren't paying attention. Right. And, the focus is different. So I had to learn to get around that. Radio was perfect for that because I could avoid people looking at me. And that was a big issue for me. That's it, that was the hardest thing to overcome. So, you know, that's kind of why.
Yeah. Then, and that's very interesting to be in that position where you can be, you know, on the, I guess you can't say behind the microphone because then you're speaking, but you can be on the production side and out of it, but still contributing to the show. And then at some point that transition, you've had me on House of Mystery. Was it just a curiosity that built over time, or was it a confidence builder thing over time of watching and learning?
Well, you know, it's, I got asked to do an interview with, Judith Vary Baker, and she was the girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald at the time of the JFK assassination.
Wow.
And I got to spend 2 hours with her. She liked me and felt comfortable with me, and it was probably because of who I am, why I am. And that interview went really well, and then radio stations started saying, hey, how about you being a host of a true crime show or history show? And I took up a station's offer in Phoenix. And that's where it all began, where I was on air. And I was still pretty uptight and pretty rigid. And it took a while to learn how to relax, because the biggest trick is to be yourself as much as possible. I'm not a whole lot different on air, off air. And it's just being able to achieve that. That's, I think, is the hardest thing.
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm good at this by any means, but, the first, I remember, asking everybody, like, the first few interviews I did, cause I came home one day and I was having so much fun doing podcasts that I just straight up told my wife, I'm like, I'm going to start a podcast. She's like, how? I'm like, I have no idea, but I'll figure it out. So I was like, I'm just going to talk to authors. That's my gig. So I remember her saying, me just being like, hey, how'd that sound? How'd I do? And I remember the first couple episodes, she's like, you know what? It would have been nice if the other person could have talked. I just didn't even realize. I'm just, every time they said something, I'm like so focused on trying to keep a conversation going that I would step right over top of them and just, you know, try to say a comment that reflected my listening to them instead of actually letting them speak. And it's funny that just trying to relax takes
an art. It's an art to be able to have a conversation and not think about that you're being recorded, watched, or listened to. right? I mean, you want to take that person to a coffee shop or to a bar and talk to them as if you're not being listened to by a huge audience. And that's kind of the tough thing to do. And actually, the person I got who I listened to that helped me over that was probably Howard Stern the most. And it sounds weird because it's not like he's my guy, but in the he's got the aspect of being able to be himself and not care and then get through the show and yet hold a pretty decent interview. That's a really tough thing to do, especially among people that don't like you. So it's that's who I kind of focus on. You might not agree with that, but that's who I focused on.
Oh no, I grew up on Howard Stern like that. every day since probably eighth grade, when I shouldn't have been listening to him, all the way through college until he went to Sirius. I was a diehard Howard Stern guy. And exactly right, especially once he started filming and putting on the video. It's different when you're listening to him, because you just hear the voices and hear the interaction. But when you can see how just laid back they're all just kind of laying around the studio, just kind of slumped in their chairs, just casually having a conversation, it adds a ton more to it when you can see how relaxed they all were and just kind of having fun. That I think it's the chemistry in that show that really built everything. Is that kind of?
Yeah, that as well as you got to realize that he's also created a character. That's how he overcame his lack of confidence in who he was, which is an ongoing process in your life, throughout your life. You know, you start out and we're all insecure at different levels, but he was totally insecure. And what he did was created Howard Stern as a character, and then he played him. And he, as time went on, he played more of himself in that character. It's a really complicated sort of sketch, but in essence, he as well as Robin both created these characters and decided to put a whack pack, as he called it, around him of people that were, you know, different, totally different. And that's sort of, I've taken on a lot of co-hosts that are all totally different than me, and they're my whack pack.
Yeah. I can hear when I listen to him, it's the dynamics just interesting, because like you say, there's just, they have different deliveries from you, and and the way you guys can play off each other is keeps it moving, especially in you know, when you have different writers, and writers are introverts by nature, so it's good to be able to tag team that with two different personalities to try and get the most out of some people who might not be very comfortable at all in sitting in radio show, you know.
Well, and the idea is I've chosen people that I really like as people, and they're also very good at what they do. Like in the thriller, Joe Goldberg, is something about him that I think he's a great person, and that's what I like. And that, so he also is a good writer in that area. And so that's why I chose him in the thriller undercover espionage sort of, because he's going to bring out serious questions as a thriller writer to other thriller writers that I won't have. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But what I do is I come into it as an outside person that's going to ask questions from someone that doesn't know anything about that. And that's kind of what I like to see in a show, because I hope when you listen, you're going to get not the typical questions. You'll get a few from Joe, but I'm going to throw things at them that they don't expect. And hopefully then it gives them, as a listener, you're going to get something out of that writer that you're not going to get on any other show. I hope that's kind of my angle.
Yeah. Just something unique that they weren't ready for. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Something off the talking points.
James Comey. The first question I asked James Comey is what kind of underwear he wore. Well, it's a joke, but at the same time, what it does is it throws him off his game. He's so rehearsed as an FBI guy. The last thing he expects is, you know, he expects me to come to him while, you know, on the Hillary Clinton angle or Donald Trump angle. Instead, here's Al going, "Do you wear boxers or briefs?" It sounds weird, but at the same time, he's like, "Oh, okay." So he has to laugh and he has to think about what he's going to say. And then you lead him into the slaughter, you know. But the thing is, I have to take him off his pre-rehearsed game. And that's kind of what I want to do. And then find out some real stuff about him, not just the same stuff you're going to get on MSNBC or Fox or whatever you watch. I want to get something real out of that person because he's a real human being. And that's kind of a hard thing to do.
Yeah. And that's what I liked about House of Mystery and those long form type shows. You're not confined to a soundbite. You can actually, like you say, you can knock them off their game and then actually have a in-depth conversation with somebody who otherwise you'd never see, you know.
Right.
You never see that aspect of them on a, you know, sitting on a contributor's desk in Fox News or CNN or something like that. You can get to try and know them instead of judging them from a 30-second soundbite.
Yeah. Because I don't really care about Trump or Clinton. I'm caring about a person that's sitting there that's talking to me about writing and doing other things. So why do I want to go there? Right. And not only that, you know, Rachel Maddow or Sean Hannity in their own context will actually do a better job at the political scale than I will. So why do I want to compete with that or go there? And not only that, it's just early in the game, I learned that if you're political, you start to draw sides. And that's kind of not what I want to do. I don't mind talking about issues, but I don't want to talk about a political opinion of that issue because it's never going to win. You're going to get people that are left or right, and they're going to love or hate whatever side you take, if you take a side. And I'm a Canadian boy. stuck in the land of America that I don't always agree with in a lot of that stuff. So I just, it's more about the issue. You can talk about an issue, guns or FBI or stuff like that, but I don't need to talk about whether Hillary Clinton is having, you know, eating babies in a basement of a pizza place or whether whatever, you know what I mean? It's a non-issue for me because most of it's just hash that you're slinging at people. And so I don't want to do that. So that's kind of why I don't really go there. So I'd rather know about, you know, and I found out James Comey about his daughter and all this other stuff that you would never hear on a regular political show. So,
yep. Yeah, because it's so polarized. It's just the filter won't allow you to get to know the actual person. It's just so much easier to judge them when you've just got a face, you know.
We would all be much closer if we actually talked to each other on a one-on-one basis or on a direct basis than we do on Twitter. You know what I'm saying? You know, because there's people like that are, I mean, you're totally probably an opposite spectrum of a political person probably than I would be. But the thing is, we're human beings and we care about ourselves, our families, our kids, our cats, as you said, like we care about that. And as humans and Americans, you would care more about if we actually sat there and talked, because it'd be like, you don't want to hurt your friends. You know what I mean? Yeah. And if we're sitting there, I think it would be a much closer nation than what it is. Because of all that hassling, and it's so easy to do it on Twitter and to call people names, but you don't want to do that to people you know. So I'm more for let's bring on the people that have different points of views, because why do they have that? They're humans. Yeah. And if we talk to them as human, then we start to realize, well, maybe their concerns are worth something. And then they'll say that about me. Because I'm a very different person. I'm not a mainstream person. So, you know, it's easy to call me names, but the truth is I'd be a better friend than an enemy. And I think that us as human beings are all much better learning from each other and caring and working together than just calling each other names because, well, you know, of whatever reason. And so... anyway, I don't want to, you know, I didn't mean to go down that angle, but it's sort of that sort of what I do.
No, and it's interesting you mentioned that, because I mean, it's the, you know, social media for everything it's It is. I mean, it's got such power to do exactly what you talk about, but instead, more often than not, people just decide to throw barbs at each other, you know, and just hide behind whatever little avatar or handle they've got. And they'd much rather pick apart than get to know each other. And I think, like, exactly like you said, shows like yours just, you know, whatever. And Comey's a very political figure, and the, you know, the left, whatever they think of him, the right, whatever they think of him. Now they, you know, he sits down with you for an hour and you can be like, oh, he's a, you know, he's a dad. He's a dedicated civil servant. He's done this. He's done this. He's, you know, yeah. Give the guy a break, right?
Yeah. You know, because the left people that hated him because he comes in and he's the conservative and he's a kind of anti-Hillary. And so there's a lot of left that hate him, but then there's right that hate him because he wasn't a Trump supporter. So, but the thing is, he's human and, you know, he had a lot of good things to, you know, one thing I had no idea. First thing he thought was, you know, he analyzed the FBI and realized that, like, you know, 86% were white male, and he wanted to change that, which was like something that left people had no idea about. You know what I mean? It was like, oh,
yeah.
What, really? Why? He's got a daughter that happens to be a lesbian. Oh, what? What? Yeah. You know, but that's not going to be, it's all about, everything is about Trump or Clinton. And I'm tired of that pearl clutching thing of either side kind of, do you hear what she said? Do you hear what he said? And it's like, drop your purse, buddy. I mean, it's just relax. This is just fodder. This is just their stuff that they sling at each other. And it really doesn't matter. But what's really about who they really are, and that's just sort of more my, so I just wanted to know more about Comey and who he was as a person. And when they talk about their family, you find out more about who they are, I think, than if they talk about Trump or Clinton, you know.
Yep. So yeah, because they're just stuck in between two political demagogues, and their armies, their respective armies, will never, you know, discuss.
You're never gonna win. Yeah, no, you're never going to win that. And what's the point of me sitting there talking for an hour about, yeah, Clinton, she's a hag, you know, or Trump, he's a loser. Like, why? What would be the point? Because like I said, you can go to your respective networks and they're going to do it much better. So I think for me, it's like, well, who are you? You know, and I throw jokes at like him, like, you know, there's something we haven't talked about. And right away, he's like all nervous thinking, oh, no, I'm going to get into Trump. And I go, and then I go, aliens, Area 51. And then it's like, yeah, he's like, what? Like, where did that come from? And he's kind of starts to laugh out of, you know, kind of because he's nervous. But then it just throws things at him that he doesn't, because I don't want that polished, rehearsed speech.
Yeah, no, throw them off their talking points. And I had somebody on the other day, and I didn't mean to do it, but I asked a question, and it probably wasn't a great question, but it knocked her off her talking points, and it just kind of had to do kind of a reset. And it was a great conversation. I loved having her on, but it was just one of those things, you know, that do so many interviews based on something, and you know, it's when you go off the canned line of questioning, it can kind of throw people off sometimes. But it's also nice because then you start digging a little deeper and really get to see, you know, the passion that people had bringing into these projects and some of the little behind the scenes things you didn't get from the, you know, just asking the overarching, you know, questions that everybody asks, you know?
Yeah. And it might be corny, but I'm hoping that when I interview someone, and however different they are from me, I'm hoping to find out what makes them tick and why they are who they are, because then I'd rather get to know the person and actually leave as a friend or at least an acquaintance that we understand each other than just to attack and be an enemy, you know. And I really got that, you know, with Comey, and I got that actually with the Making a Murderer, that whole thing from Netflix. And when I had a lot of the people on there, like, you know, the prosecutor, Ken Kratz, who everybody hated, and just having him on the show twice was a relief in the sense that, you know, I was able to talk to him about the bad things, but also who he was as a person, you know. And yeah, I that's probably one of my first largest hate mail campaigns I had against me, which is kind of, you know, a learning lesson too, right?
Because you gave the guy the opportunity to speak when he's already condemned in the public square.
Yeah, and not only that, because it's not like, you know, I even said to him, you know, it's funny because he chose me too. He let me be his interviewer. And at the same time, it was kind of like, why? And because I think I had a different angle and I wasn't just going to call him a name, but I still was going to ask him about things. And I think that, so that was good. That made me feel better about myself. And of course, a lot of people were like, you weren't tough enough on him. You didn't, what, I didn't call him enough names. Well, geez, yeah. You know, how do I, you know, what if he was your brother? What if he was your neighbor? What if he was someone you grew up with? There's people that are going to love this guy because he's mm-hmm. their family. So let's find out why. Let's find out why. I don't necessarily want to end up leaving and being his buddy, but, you know, at least give him the opportunity as a human being to kind of go, well, what was going on with you that you were doing these things that, you know, like he was doing things to girls that had been arrested and yeah. asking them to do things. And yeah, so listen, you know, and I said that to him, I said, a lot of people don't like you. Yeah. And, you know, maybe there's good reason, but what's going on with you? Like, why are you who you are? And let's get into it. And I think that's, isn't that more compassion and more of a human than just being like, what's the point of me coming on to, oh, you're an ass and you're this, that, and this, and just kind of slamming you. It's like, well, listen, everybody has their good days and bad days. And I want to be fair, you know, and that's yeah, kind and- of, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, whenever those documentaries are made, the writing's agreed upon. And no matter how deep that interview goes, it's not going to make it to the final product. So whatever the variables or the facts and circumstances, you know, I'm not saying you could, you know, justify some of that behavior, but, you know, you won't get the overall, you know, the overarching, you know, whole story of what made that person, you know, but and so they get crucified. And actually, I don't want to jump off talking about the show and guests too much, because you've had a bunch of guests that I would love to ask questions about. But it just immediately reminded me of your book, The Innocent Man, or no, sorry, Last Man Standing, the McCullough story, which I found fascinating. It goes into a bigger question as to how you choose the stories you want to tell. But I feel like we've hit on that. But in the Last Man Standing, this guy falsely convicted of a child murder and then exonerated after horrible prison experience. What was it that led you to pick that story to tell?
Well, you know, it's access is one thing, you know, because I was doing a show in Seattle at that time, and his stepson had heard and listened to the show and contacted me, which, wow, that made me feel good about myself. But I think that's that. So I had access to him, and because I don't want to do a book on someone that if I can't have access to him, and if they're not into it, you know, like every one of these modern day crimes, I have to be able to deal with the family, the killers or the accused and the survivors. I want people to be involved in it because it's their story, not mine. Mm-hmm. And I want to understand it. So if people are into it, then, and he approached and said, you know, we've just had really bad hack writers write about him. And I want someone that will take on the story that will tell the truth. And so at the same time, I said, well, then he has to tell the truth. I'm not going to lie,
yeah.
You know, I'm going to go through. And so, you know, and then I got to meet him, and that was an experience in itself. And so that's kind of how I took it. And the book is kind of about that, meeting someone that first thing he says to me is, my son thinks I'm a racist, and America went to hell the moment they let a woman go to work. I thought, wow, this is a guy that everyone's going to hate. And wow. Actually, and when you meet him and talk to him, You see, and that's the back to what we're saying, you know, you meet someone that's completely opposite, but you can talk to them and realize, understand them. And I did, you know, and he had some really wacko ideas, you know, but believe me, and he's not necessarily a guy you want over at Christmas and you don't want him hanging out. But at the same time, we can't just put them away because we don't like them, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of, I think, where I took the point of the book. Look, you know, this is a guy that you probably won't like. You probably wouldn't get along with for a lot of reasons. You know, what's the first thing he says to the judge when he's convicted? Just don't put me in a cell with a Black, a Jew, or a Democrat. Oh,
okay. He just got everybody. He just went after, you know, everybody.
It's like, holy cow. So yeah, he's not necessarily going to be your favorite guy.
Wow.
But do we want to live in a place that we just put him away because he isn't our favorite guy? You know, mm-hmm. He's the handy guy to hate. So yeah, he did it. And he didn't, because you ruin the guy's life. You ruin a lot of his family's lives. And it's just because we don't like them. And that, I think I'm totally against that, because I've had that towards me just because they don't like me for who I am. And I think, well, this is crazy. This isn't, you know, I'm not asking you to be friends. We don't have to live together. We don't have to go hang out together, but we need to understand each other and kind of understand that, oh, listen, you know, we don't want to just be putting people away because we don't like them. Or they don't like us, you know. It's a free country, so you just don't be a friend with them. That's all, you know. And so
yeah,
I think that was
an important story. Know, yeah,
I think so too. I wished I was a better writer when I wrote it. I wished I was today. I could write that story because I would do such a better job. Not that I'm slamming it. It's got a pretty good rating, but it never. I think because I have that angle. Not everyone loves it, you mm-hmm. know. It did overall pretty good, but I think that I would write it better today. But I'm not saying don't buy it.
Right. So focusing on the due process instead of being like, yeah, you're not going to like this dude, but we should tell you what happened to him, right?
Yeah. And it's kind of one of those. It was definitely a good lesson for all of us, because I found out things about him that he didn't want published. And I had the FBI files, and it was like, he was like, well, I don't want this published. And it was about him having sex with his stepsister. Jeez. And that was a harsh thing. And I had to take a while and kind of go, well, you know what? It's important to the story, but I'm not going to go into detail, but it's part of something that people need to read. So I was kind of one of those hitting things that kind of, I had to deal with. But, you know, again, you have to tell the truth or you can't write the book, you know?
Right. And all the books that you've, the 30 books that you've written, and especially some of the people you've dealt with, like I'm Mr. McCullough doesn't sound like the easiest guy to deal with, but when those issues come up, like whether it's the family or whether it's a freaking serial killer, how do you broach that topic when they say, I don't want that in there. And you're like sitting there staring down a really bad people being like, well, it's going in there. What are you going to do? Right.
Well, I think, at the beginning, you see, that's why I wished if I could write it now, it would be slightly different because I'd have more balls than I did then because I was more nervous, but I always go into it kind of going and talking to people, listen, it's got to be all or nothing. You know, I can understand certain things being kind of left out because it's just salacious. It's just stuff people are, you know, they want. I'm not going to get into that. So that's easy. But at the beginning, you got to be straightforward with them. And with the killer like that, Murder Time 6 is probably the one that I did that the best with, because I talked to everybody. We've got the killer in prison, his new wife. I've got also all the victims. They all were involved, the cop that arrested them. I just got everybody involved, and I made sure they all read the book before the publisher put it out. So in a way, I did that the best. That I think I had the system down by the time I did Murder Time 6. So that's kind of the best true crime book I think I've ever written because of that. But they have to know that, and when you walk in, they just have to know. Listen, I'm not out to get you. I just want the story, and I'm going to give the best I can to all of you. And so, you know, when you write about the victims in that story that were the little girls that were he had raped and killed, it was like, how much of the story do I need to tell? And the family, they're very much important to kind of, because I don't want to just write a book that's gore and, you know, the blood is dripping and you could smell this and that. You know, that's there. And there's people that do that really well. But I think that, I think it's more about the subject than that. So,
and that was a mass murder in West Park. That was West Park Six. Is that what that is?
It's the Wells Gray Park. He spotted the two girls playing on his way home from work at the park. And then he watched the family for 3-4 days. And then he killed the family, the parents and the grandparents, so that he could have sex with these two little girls, 9 and 11, I think it was at the time. And I don't need to get into what he did to them. He did tell me. We went through all the details, but half the family was, well, we already know this and we don't care. And the other half were like really sensitive to it. So I think, you know, all I needed to do was put in what he said to me about it. And when he talked about the 9-year-old, here's a guy, this reason it's important is the guy was up for parole. Okay. Yeah. And he's going to get out. He's married to a new woman who met him online, and this new wife has two girls the same age of the ones that he raped killed. So that in itself is the story. It doesn't need to be about the details of what he did to him, but when he said to me, one thing was really stuck out to me, because when he said to me that I no longer fantasize about little girls anymore since I've been married to an adult female. Okay, this is what you say, you know, and he's found the Lord. Okay, so he, you know, he kind of go, okay, that's your credit. But then he's telling me about the details of what he did to the 9-year-old. And without getting into it, what he said to me, he goes, well, you know, I tried with her for almost 24 hours and she didn't understand anything. Even though I tried to show her how to do things, she still didn't get it. So I shot her in the fucking head, is what he said to me. So I'm thinking, all I need to do is write that. And it says it all. I don't need to get into what he did to her. I just need to tell you, this is who he is. And the question is, do you really want him out living in the free and being your neighbor? Even if you don't have girls, you know?
Yeah. Do they deserve to? I mean, is there... Yeah, regardless of sentencing guidelines, like there's just some people that shouldn't be around, you know.
Personally, personally, I think they should have just put him down. I have this awful opinion that causes controversy, because even though I have a strong left side in the political ring, I still think, listen, this guy, we know for a fact what he did to these people. He killed 7 people in all before he was 23.
Yeah.
And did terrible things to these two little girls. No. If we're in a country that's decided we're not going to kill them, okay, fine. That's what the country's decided. It's a free country. That's what they want. No death penalty. Okay? Fair enough.
And this is in Canada.
Yeah. But, you know, even in most of the states. But even though that may be the case, fair enough. Then that's how it is. But that person should never be out.
Yeah. You know? And you mentioned the patrol aspect, parole aspect. I mean, you mentioned when you're writing the manuscript, you know, the family has to know that there's going to be uncomfortable things in here and that everybody has to be in, and that the story takes precedent. It might be uncomfortable, but this needs to be in here to tell your story and your family's story. But when you talk about him, the question of should he go to parole, every time he goes up to parole, whatever surviving family members have to rip off the Band-Aid and suffer through living that experience over. Right. I mean, in this case, the survivors might be, you know, nobody survived him, but, you know, there's the family members who have to, you know, wake up thinking about their the people they lost in the horrible way that they were lost. And every time that guy gets to weaponize the justice system, every time he gets to stand for parole, it just victimizes everyone all over again.
Yeah. And it's every year and a half. And I do focus on that. And in the first edition, I have one of the letters. It's funny. It's not funny, but it was strange. One of the cousins, the girls, right, that's about the same age. So she grows up with this. And every time her kids go camping or go do something, she's terrified for the whole time, the whole weekend. And that was the essence of her letter that she wrote. And so the parole board sends it back saying, no, it's a little too hard. And I thought, this is ridiculous, but that's all right. This is the system. We won't get better at it unless we really see it and understand it. So to me, it's like, I have to put this in there and go, this is too harsh. Really?
Right.
Okay. You know, come on, look at what the guy did. I mean, you know, and so I think that's it, you know, and actually the police did give me a little grief in that they give it a 4 out of 5 stars. And they took the 1 star away was because I was kind of down, being a little down on parole and stuff. And it's like, no, I'm not down on parole. The truth is, I think everyone has that right. That's fair. But what happens to these survivors when they have to relive this every year and a half? And the one even had, she even talked about how she gets letters every month. You know, the killer's, you know, he's gone to see a doctor. He had a tooth pulled. He has liver problems. They get details every month or two. And the first time I met some of the survivors, you're sitting in a house with them. One of the girls, who was probably about 45, cried from the minute I got there to the minute I left, because it's still fresh because of things like this. You know,
and they never goes away.
Yeah, and they can't just kind of move on. It's too hard. And you know, go see him every year and a half in a parole hearing and sit there for 3 days and listen to him, how he's found God and how he's changed. It's like, it's got to be difficult, right?
Yeah, and I mean, over time, you know, victims' rights laws have come a long way, but that some point, in the more, you know, you write things like this, or somebody puts out something that with a focus on the victims and shows the way the system abuses these people, that I don't know if we'll ever get to the point of having that conversation of balancing the criminal's rights versus the victim's rights. I think that conversation is there a little bit, but the overall, like, at what point do you make a call that this person does not need to be part of society anymore? Let their actions speak for them being excised from the community. You know, it's because there's no way to fix it.
There's no way. And the thing is, people like that guy in particular, and he's one of many, never has to get counseled. You know what I mean? They don't have to see psychiatrists. We can't force that on them. So do they really ever get better, you know? And how do you justify that to people? You know, there's people scared of him still that moved and are scared totally that he'll get out. You know, it's affected a lot of people. You know, the cameras go away and it's off the topic of TV and crime shows for a while. But the rest of the people still go on living, and it's I think that was, see, so for me, that's the focus of the book. So the family and the survivors have to kind of approve what I write before it gets published. That's my goal. Not everybody sees it that way, and that's what freedom is. Go for it. You want to write that gory story, go for it. Some of them do it really well, and they publish, and some of them sell a ton of books, and that's great. That's what it is, but not really what I do.
And that you know, talking about the McCullough and talking about the Murder Time 6 cases, how is it? I mean, 30 books. How is it you choose the stories? Sometimes they come to you, like the guy's son reaching out to you, or do you find that thread of, you know, Mr. McCullough, he was denied due process, you know, tortured in jail and then released, or, you know, the re-victimization of the survivors every time this killer wants to try and stand parole. What's your, I guess, triaging method of how you select what you're going to write about?
Well, they all come to me. I never go out looking, you know, and it's a bad way to say it, but I always say America's the drive-through of killing, and it's cruel. It's just my, you know, you have to know that when you're in it, and I've been around so many cops and so many people in the biz, so to speak, that you have kind of this callous, this attitude, this dark humor, because that's a way of dealing with it. You know, it's hard to deal with. So that's why I say things like that. So no offense. It's just sort of,
I've never heard it put that way. That's that. Yeah.
Well, it is. It's the drive through of murder.
Yeah. There's so much. We're a violent bunch. There's no way around it. Yeah.
No. Fair enough. It is what it is. I don't hold it against anybody. I'm like I said, I'm a Canuck stuck in it. And I just sort of, I observe a lot. I just see a lot of people that are, you know, I love my cop friends. I love everybody I've met in that business. And they're totally that way. And I think that's sort of what makes them special. But that also what they need to deal with what they do and the people they deal with. So I'm all for it. So they come to me and I hear about it. And I put a post-it. It's all over one of my computers. And I look for it. And, you know, a lot of them come to me from a hairdresser or from a person or from whoever. And I kind of look at it. And if it's not a case that's, if it's a case that people, I approach people, if the story sounds interesting and I can get into the storyline itself or something about it, then I approach people. And if they're all in on it, then I start following and start putting in requests to meet and go to a prison or do things. And if it comes together, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't. That's why I've always got, I got like 5 crime cases going right now. Because you wait for details to come back and wait to see if you can get into that prison, if that person will see you, or if this cop is interested, or if this victim is interested. They've got to be involved. And if I get a lot of no's, it stays on the computer and I keep working on other cases. And they just sort of come together, you know. When I get all the evidence and get everything I can together, then I fly to a city. I fly to a city I've never been to before, book in a hotel, and stay there the whole time and write the book.
Oh, no kidding. You just plant right down and just go, huh?
Yeah. When I have it all together and I fly somewhere, because what it does is there's not a feeling like being in a city of a couple of million people that are all strangers.
Yeah. Yeah.
That creates a
fascinating
mood. Yeah, and it puts you in a situation of survival, and I just love that being a stranger, being lonely in a crowded room. It's amazing, and then that's where you get some of your best writing that way. And then I can put the story together. So that's
a cool bit of stress that you add to yourself. Will it be the city in which this particular case has taken place, or will it be random darts?
It's got to be a place. Yeah, it's got to be somewhere I've never been to before. Because I got to be alone, and I got to feel alone in amongst a million people. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, there's that. There was a Madonna wrote a song 100 years ago like that, and about not a hit. It was just a song, and there's something in it about being so lonely in such a crowded room. And I thought that's the true feeling of inspiring yourself to write. And that's kind of one of the most exciting parts of it. Now I find that I can do research wherever I have to do it. But when you actually do the writing part and you want to get into the story, you got to stress yourself into that situation. For me, anyway, that's how I do it.
That's I would love to try that.
It works really awesome. Well.
Yeah, and I remember back in my traveling days, it'd be, you know, traveling from, you know, through countries or in transit to places. It was, there's something that's a very freeing about being in a place where, you know, you don't know anybody, you don't even speak the language, you've never seen this, you know, before, and just walking amongst the crowd and everybody knows what's going on in the place, but you, you know, yeah, just being, totally. There's a lot of freedom to that being lost, but there's also that heightened level.
Right. Yeah, right. And so, yeah. You know, and I have that suspicious thing, you know, about that spy thing, you know, so I, you know, I'm always looking in the mirrors, checking on people and looking around me. I'm so, so observant. It's so I'm on edge.
Yeah, that's what? I can see that. I can see that inspiring some writing time. I could totally, that little bit of stress, that little bit of heightened sensitivity. And it creates
emotions that you don't get when you're in a safe space, when you're at home.
Yep.
Right. Wow. So I think it just makes the story better. So for me, it works anyways. It has so far. I mean, who knows? You know, like yeah. I said, you know, where's it all going? I don't know. But it works for me. That's kind of how I do it.
Yeah. It's worked 30 times. So that's,
yeah. And most of them have done really well. There's a few dogs.
Well, you can't hit it out of the park every time. I guess well, save some for everybody else. Right.
It's strange. I did that one book about the, and I just hated it. You know, I liked the story, but the publisher, you know, what did they call it? Deadly Betrayal, you know, about some yep. daughter, and they call it Daughter from Hell. And I was like, oh, you got to be kidding, right? They changed the title on me and they made the cover and it was just all this shock. The story was okay, but I was just like so turned off by that. And I went with it because I was a new guy. And but years later, all of a sudden, these department store chains and these bookstores, all of a sudden I was getting these like through Ingram telling me that, you know, 1,200 books, 1,400 books, all these books were being sold to these stores. So for some reason, it just catches on 10 years later. And you're like, oh, you know, it's wow. Why? There's no reason.
Yeah, right. That's there's no telling. Marketing's a mystery to me. But yeah. It did make me wonder, looking at the business side, when you're working through a manuscript and you've got all these people involved from the subject to the investigator, to the victims, to the family, when they get their take, have you ever had the publisher come back and be like, now, it doesn't matter what they're saying. This is what we want this to look like.
No, not to
never
that
had
extent.
That kind of pushback.
No, the only time I've ever had pushback is on sometimes on expressions like the Leopold and Loeb story. It's kind of like one of the best things, and it's also been one of the hardest things I had to go through, because, you know, publishers come back and say, well, you know, you use some of their language, you know, one killer saying to the other, you know, I remember the one saying was he absolutely wouldn't burn any place or hurt anybody in the Portuguese ghetto. You know, back in the 20s in Chicago, and the publisher said, well, you can't say that. It's like, well, I'm not saying it. That's what one guy said to the other killer as they're talking, because there was a reason. And then it's like, well, yeah, but you know, ghetto is a derogatory term and people think black neighborhood, and they say, oh, so you can you change it to working class neighborhood? It's like, well, no, yeah. Because you know, listen, I could it just expression, like if I was just describing the neighborhood, sure. But this is like one guy is this dialogue, one person's talking to the other, and this is what they're saying. One guy doesn't go, oh, stay away from the Portuguese working class neighborhood.
That's right. Not maybe in a Disney movie.
Yeah, that's just not what we say. This is we're talking right. Killers and people are bad people. So it doesn't work. So I remember things like that. And I don't like changing that. So that ended up going to a different publisher because we couldn't settle on things.
Wow.
Because that's some people have that, you know, and that's, again, it's freedom. I just think, yep. Well, okay, fine. Fair enough. There's somebody else that'll do it.
Yeah.
And someone else did, but the first book caused me so much grief. I still get backlash from this and from people that are angry at me over this. And it's been kind of one of the, and, you know, strange thing is then Discovery approaches me and they want to do that whole series as a series, as a killer series on Discovery Crime, Internet or whatever. I was like, oh, okay.
Well, and it's interesting. The That's your Killer Queen series.
Yeah.
And it follows the way starting with Leopold Loeb in 1927 Chicago up through the guy in Toronto who was burying his victims in flower beds. I can't remember the guy's name.
Yeah, Bruce MacArthur.
Yeah. MacArthur. But yeah, as you, and I haven't been able to get through all your books, but as you go through from Leopold to MacArthur, focusing on homosexual related crimes and murder, the change over time of, from at one point in time, to a homosexual relationship would be considered a felony, and then it changes to non-criminal activity, and then it as it changes over time, what trends have you seen in that overriding that book over that almost 100-year span?
Well, it caught me because originally Leopold and Loeb were in the 20s in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they were from a wealthy family, and they were, gay together at times. But at the same time, Leopold and Loeb, they were really big time Hitler supporters. And he was totally one was so upset when Hitler got put in jail originally, when he got arrested, put in jail for 5 years. And yet they were, and the one was Jewish. And I thought, well, this is just so weird, right? What's going on? So I wanted to get into them. But at the same time, Fritz Haarmann was murdering people in Germany, in Hanover. Mm-hmm. And he was a police informant, but yet he was gay. But I saw how the two cities and the two countries treated their homosexual community. And that's what intrigued me, because of the way they felt about gay people in that time in each city, they treated the crimes differently. Yep. That was the angle for me. It was that was what was catching me on that story. It wasn't so much the details of the murder. Again, it got to be more about how each community treated their citizens that were gay because of how they felt about it. And in Hanover, it was festive. It was party. It was okay. They had police permits to walk around so transsexuals could walk around and not be arrested in Hanover and in Berlin. Wow. It became a festive cabaret style thing. It was huge. And mm-hmm. so they treated gay killers different than they did in Germany or in Chicago. That's what led me down that road. And so I started going through the years and putting it together, and right up into San Francisco and Canada, and it just sort of it's strange how each book, how you can kind of go through a country and see how they were dealing with it, and the police raiding gay places and stuff, and how they mm-hmm. and it's funny, the one in Chicago, the captain of the police in Toronto was, or in Canada, I'm sorry, is how he was saying that we could never hire a homosexual because they're criminals. I just loved the quotes of how, so therefore, when you have that, of course, when a gay person commits a crime, then he's really bad. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So, but now in modern days, it's pretty good in most countries. Comparatively, it's been a huge change. But, look at, I bring up things like Alan Turing, right? The guy that, he was the big savior code breaker in the World War II. And because he had gay sex with a man, they castrated him.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just bringing out the variables and stuff. I was just fascinated with that more than anything, more than the crime.
And it was part of a plea deal, which is the craziest part. Just really just destroying the man's body for a plea deal,
Yeah, because he was dirty, yet he was a really important figure in the war. Like it's just amazing how people get things in their minds. That's all. I just sort of wanted to follow that. And it's caused a lot of problems doing that series, I will tell you.
Really? Because I what fascinated me about it is exactly, I love it when you can see a society's reflection in a story. And I think with each one of these, you see society's reflection. It's you make society look in the mirror in the way that these things are addressed in these different periods of time. And I love it when you show it makes people uncomfortable, right? Because you're not you're not pointing at a judge, you're not pointing at a prosecutor, you're not pointing at a detective. You're pointing at the people, you're pointing back at the people reading it at the time, saying this is everybody, you know, everybody's thoughts were what contributed to the way history. These people are treated.
It's just history.
I love it. I love it when you can put that mirror up to people.
Yeah. And I think that's all it is. And I think, people are uncomfortable. And so I get a lot of really, really great feedback and a lot of really hateful feedback. But then you see, I was doing it. I was, I think, in the fourth book. And this was two years ago, April, and Tucker Carlson on Fox came after me, and that started an avalanche because he had such a big profile at the time because he was on Fox, and he said some really bad things about me and about the show. And NBC came back at me and said, "You say absolutely nothing. We don't want this to grow." And it was just because I did a sound bite, and so then, and all it was just something. This is sort of what social media, and all it was NBC in LA asked me about in Canada, because Tucker Carlson, they showed me a clip on Fox, and he said that in Canada, you know, the Trudeau was arresting the citizens for and putting them in internment camps if they didn't get the vaccine. And how long before Joe Biden does this? And it was like, so they asked me, and I said, "Well, I don't know what he's talking about, because there's no internment camps in Canada, first off, and they're not arresting people for not getting the vaccine. There's companies and health places, there's places firing people if they don't get it, but there's no internment camps and no one's being arrested." But I said, and then I made a comment, "Well, it's just typical Tucker, right? He's just making up stuff, right?" Mm-hmm. And so he didn't like that, and his people didn't like it. So he said that he wouldn't listen to my show unless he wanted to learn how to be gay.
Wow, that's taking a high road.
And then all of a sudden I started getting 200 people a day following me, like on Facebook and stuff. And then they were sending me dirty pictures of men doing bad things with animals.
Wow, that's Tucker's people, Tucker's fans.
And they had to take over my social media for almost 3 months and run it, because it went crazy. And I didn't know how to deal with it, be honest. And actually it freaked me out, because there's a national news figure saying something about me. Like that was like bizarre. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
well, I'm just a Canuck. I'm from Kanakistan. Don't bother me.
Kanakistan.
it's silly when you think about it, because I wasn't taking a political point of view. I was just answering a question, and I didn't expect that. And of course, then I'm doing these Killer Queen books, and oh my God.
And that's worth taking a shot at you for.
Oh my God. So they just everyone attacked me, and I just didn't want anything to do with it. Shut me down in that sense. I want nothing to do with this whole gay scenario and books and stuff. And it took a while to get out of that. Again, I wished I was now and this happened, because I can handle it better now, because I've been through it. I'm in a different side now. I'm a lot stronger, I guess, than I was. So they have bad memories for me, though, that series of books, which is really too bad. Because I think I did some really good work there, but that's kind of the world.
Like looking through, you know, as I was looking, the stories you choose to tell are they're not comfortable. You just said this is what we are, you know, this is what we are, and this is how we've treated people over time, and this is
I don't want to be judgmental, because I'm not doing it to say, "Oh, look at you," I'm looking at it as, and look, you know, we're just, that's why I mean, you know, about the whole, my opinion on politics, how about this, just people need to start speaking to each other and meeting each other and really getting into it's not us, them, and all this. And it's the same with these books. I'm just writing history and crime, and this is what happened. This is how it happened. And I don't want to make a statement, and I don't want to, You know, it's like the old canceling, you know, let's start, you know, canceling people from the past. It's who they were, you know, and this is society. Let's try and talk about it and learn. It makes me uncomfortable too, right? It's just
look back and learn.
I mean, because I want it better for the kids, not worse. You know, you want each generation,
and trying to get people to be self-reflective is not a comfortable thing.
it's hard.
It's just not.
It's hard. It's hard. And that's kind of, you know, and politically, that's sort of the negativity now. And it's just, it's really sad because it's kind of, it's the Trump method in a way of everyone just slams everyone and it's okay. Just call everyone names and throw in. It's like, no, it's not okay. It's, you know, it's just, you know, we don't have to like everyone, but come on, you know, it's not that way.
It is definitely a de-evolution of society to the point where you can't talk to somebody you disagree with.
Yeah. Cause I don't know, you know, it used to be, you could, and it used to be, I used to make fun of presidents and people before, you know, Clinton in the blue dress, look at all that. And now you can't, it's just, it's really crazy now. And everyone's so serious and so mean and God, I don't understand that. I really don't, you know, but that's what we're stuck with now, you know? So,
yeah. And I mean, until we can get back to appreciate intelligent discourse, I guess I don't know when that happens, but it's.
Yeah. It's, and when's it going to end? Because, you know, it's funny when I talk to, Peter Vronsky, the doctor, he's history professor too, and he's written some good books, and he, talked about that, about the serial killers in the 70s and about how our, you know, the baby boomers and how their kids grow up and, you know, the parents come back from the war and men wouldn't touch the boys and it was all this stuff. And I think, and he was talking about, well, what do you think's going to happen from the kids now? A lot of the kids born into all this discourse that we're going through, how are they going to grow up? That's the thing I think that we're missing. We don't realize the effect our behavior has on the young generation.
They don't know anything but you know, falsified strife and flag waving. You know, regardless of whatever tribe, everybody's got to have a tribe.
And I you know, I couldn't join a political party, and I don't understand it. I just see it as, you know, someone runs, what do they say? How about politics? How about politicians talking about schools, education, and serious stuff? You know, they can't even make our roads smooth, you know,
right?
They can't fix our roads. How are they going to do, you know? I just want to see some real stuff, medicine and medical, and start talking about things that affect our life. Not, I don't care about most of the stuff they talk about. So I don't even turn on the news now.
Yeah. Sad. I can't stomach it most of the time anymore. It's just because there's zero substance. They're just taking shots at each other. But
I love it when they talk about something and then they say something that happened and then they bring on people and they all talk about it for a half hour.
Yeah. They just talk over each other. Like they just bounce in sound bites.
So I'm stuck. I'm writing all this stuff in the 60s and the 80s now. It's what I've been focusing on now. So what I do, this is the really cool thing, I think, is all I watch is shows from the 60s.
Well, that'd be fun. I could see that being fun. Yeah.
Right now, all I'm doing is, you know, Perry Mason and What's My Line, and I'm doing all this 60s because you pick up so much dialogue from people and what they thought was funny and what they didn't, how they dressed, how they talked. You learn so many interactions that when you're writing a book in that time, you can put that into it. You know, and expressions. I love doing this. So it's been good for me not watching modern day stuff.
Right. Well, and also you know, it'd be great for the current generation to just sit back and watch the context with which all these triggering conversations are now. You know, like you can, you know, you put on, I would love to sit like an 18-year-old down and have them watch, you know, every Mel Brooks movie from beginning to end. And
that's
just,
right.
And just that's watch right. How watch them need to be medicated, you know?
The thing is, because it's just, you start to realize that, you know, we lived in a time and this is how it was. And it's just, I don't know. I'm sort of stuck in that right now. I'm really big in the 60s. But it really helps my writing, I think, in that, and really in capturing who the people were and the characters much better than trying to do it from a 2023 point of view, you know?
Yeah.
Because you don't understand the character if you don't put what was around them and how they were feeling. Yeah, you know, but I think that's sort of, you know, history's important.
Yeah, history is important, and all that context is lost unless you try to immerse yourself in it, you know. But we've been going about an hour, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I did have one more question with all the spectrum that you've studied as far as all these different cases, all these different subjects over time, because it's more than most. In all this research, I don't know how, you know, over the 30 books, has there ever been a time that, you know, you're researching a certain guy or maybe talking to a certain subject or a killer, and you just, and some of these people, this class of serial killer just start to make sense to you, or these, you know, these people who are convicted of these, you know, awful things, they somehow you're like, okay, I understand what's wrong with this person. Like, have you ever kind of thought, okay, this is a class of people you can diagnose as psychotics and put them in this little box, or over time, have you just been like, I don't get what sets these people off? You know,
no.
Have you ever seen a trend?
No, I'm not qualified. Yeah. I'm not qualified. I'm really not. And the people that most of the time too, when you see shows and you see all these, they bring in people and they start telling you what's wrong and why they do things. Most of that is just, it's BS. It's just throwing stuff at the wall. I think that, I think it's fine, but it's not concrete. And I don't know, you know, I wished I knew, but we don't. You know, yeah. I hate it when they come on and they say, oh, his father was an alcoholic and beat him every day, and his mother was out smoking and a tramp or whatever. And I think that's what my dad was, you know, right. And I grew up with worse than half these people, and I'm not interested in hurting anybody. I've never even had the desire. There's something else physically wrong, mentally, you know, there's something that, it's not just, there's, I don't know, like I said, I'm not qualified, but there's more to it than that surface stuff you hear on most of the shows. And that's one thing I've learned is I couldn't give you an answer. I wish there was, I wished we could solve it and understand why people are this way. I don't know. Sorry to disappoint you, but.
Oh, that's all right. I didn't know if you'd have an answer for that or not, but I just look at it. All the work you've done and all the people that you've talked to over time, I would have a hard time seeing that you could put this group of people in a box. I don't think that's possible.
You can't. There's
just too many variables. Yeah.
You can learn a lot of patterns, and there's a lot of really qualified psychiatrists that could probably tell you, pick out things, but, and there is, but where it comes from, I think there's so much more to it than what makes, you know, why did Dahmer go nuts? Was it because his dad was the way he treated him? Well, I don't know. Like I said, I've been through worse, and I've known people that have been through worse family lives, and they're not that way. So there's more to it than that.
Yep.
And I wished I knew. And again, you know, it gets back to that. A lot of these people, we don't really ever know, you know, Charles Manson, why was he the way he was? We can make a lot of guesses, but you know, we never really got to study these people.
No,
you know, no. Like, and professionals, always, you know.
Yeah, and you're only able to listen to what they say. You don't, you know, you're always got to filter through their whatever line they want to spew, you know.
Yeah, so. And they're all putting on a show. Everyone I've ever met, mm-hmm. and you go into a prison, it's a show. They are entertaining you. They do something for something. They want something. And you have to take it with a grain of salt. You have to step back and look at the big picture and go, there's a reason they're doing all of this. And, you know, it's a really weird business.
Yes,
you know, yes, really weird. That's why I respect cops and all the people that work in, you know, in medical and policing and all of that, military, even if I don't like them and they're completely opposite, of me. I respect them because I understand that I need them in order for our society to get through what it gets through, you know? So
yeah, it takes all kinds to make a community. So,
oh, it does. It does. But, I need that, you know, I need them. And
we need more of that. We need more of that kind of discussion.
Well, yeah, because we got to understand, you know, you need that, the really tough redneck fireman that's up there fighting the fires. I may not like who they are, or may not agree with them politically, or you know what I'm saying, but they're part of us. They are us. We are them. And we need that. And I appreciate that. I appreciate the effort and the work and all of that stuff. You know, I love my reddest neck friends because I need them. I may not always want to listen to them, but it's true. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And I appreciate, I appreciate the far rednecks that I have in my life that like me and need me. And there's a reason. It's because we connect and we understand each other. And you know, and God, I mean, we need more of that, you know,
but yeah, we definitely need more discourse, more communication. That's for sure.
I mean, totally. I'm into it. That's actually the reason I write the books and the reason I do the shows. It's more the people I've met. It's networking. It's just, it's so much more to it than just the finished product. Just like the interviews, you know, when you get them published and put out there, there was so much more to it when I meet people and talk to them and pick up things from them. That's so much better than the finished product, you know? So,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
That's me.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you joining me tonight. This has been a great conversation. I feel like we could have talked for hours, but I wouldn't do that to you. I don't know, you know, between the five different projects you got going on, I can't take up too much of your time.
No, and then I've got an old dog to take care of too, right? Because I got 3 acres, and so I take on the old dogs. I get them from the pound. So I've been doing that 25 years. And so quite often. So I've got a 19-year-old Jack Russell.
This is probably just scratching the door.
No, right? Actually, he's pretty calm. He's pretty calm.
Oh, yeah. They relax at some point.
Oh, yeah. Like I've got a video of him. I walked him in the snow just yesterday. And no, his girlfriend died. So he's depressed. She was 20.
Wow.
And she passed in January. So I'm out walking him and stuff like that. He's pretty pepper for his age. But no, he's good. He's pretty calm, but he doesn't leave my side. Doesn't matter if I'm in the studio or if I'm at home or anywhere. So I've got that too on top of the projects.
Yes. So, well, anytime you want to discuss more of your projects, you let me know, and we'll sit down and chat. And but before I let you go, your website, alanrwarren.com for your private website, and then you've got Instagram is.
Oh yeah. You know, on the website, it's got all of them up there, but I'm on all of it now. You know, I'm Blue Sky, Instagram, you know, Twitter, X, you know, whatever that is, TikTok, Facebook. I do it all. And, it's just all L&R Warren. Our Radio Cub is the name, and it comes in under any of them. And the website has them all. I'm on at 5-6 in the morning to do all the posts, and then I go on again at 8-9 at night. That's it. I don't go on the rest of the time. So
it helps you stay out of the arguments that way.
Well, you know, I post and I run. Yeah. Sometimes I'll look at a few. I flick through and I try to support people. I see them if they post something, I'll share it and click it. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff. And it's kind of getting out of hand too, because I know Facebook, there's 85,000 followers I have now. I don't know where they came from. I don't know what.
The show. They came from the show and the books.
But there's too many. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just that you get on and it's just, I don't see anything. I just see stuff. And then it's hard to keep up with people. People say, did you see I posted this? And it's like, no.
Nope.
I don't. Yeah, there's almost too much now. Mm-hmm. I don't know how big stars do it. I don't know how they do it when they got millions of people. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have that problem.
You tell me, you've got a million. So. Don't you have a million yet?
I'm working on 1,000,005. I'll start bragging when I get 1,000,005.
No, they must hire people. You know, they must hire
gotta
people.
Gotta be. Right. Yeah. I couldn't do it. Yeah. I couldn't do it. It's
too much. That's way too many. You know, but
But anyway, thank you for coming on tonight. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah. Take care of yourself. Stay away from bad things.
I'll try. It doesn't always work, but all right. Good night, everybody.